You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from the Life is Good Ping podcast. Join co-founders of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs, as they talk to influential musicians, athletes, business leaders, and everyday people about the role of optimism in their lives. They'll also end each episode with a ping pong charity challenge where the winner gets to donate to the charity of their choice. The Life is Good Ping podcast kicked off Thursday, June 13th with the legendary Ringo Starr. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Spotify, or iTunes and add some good vibes to your day. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. When Adam Savage first began his career building special effects models for films like Star Wars Episode II and The Matrix Reloaded, he never would have dreamt that he would one day step in front of the camera to host his own hit television series, become a leading science communicator, and the poster boy for a whole new generation of makers and builders. After all, he's still just having fun doing what he loves, making cool stuff and blowing it up, whether it's on his hit Discovery Channel series Mythbusters or his spin-off for young people, Mythbusters Jr. Now the man who makes the impossible possible is stepping it up a notch, building and testing some of the most over-the-top contraptions from fiction, history, and the movies for his new series Savage Builds, which airs Fridays at 10 Eastern on the Science Channel. And today, Adam Savage comes on the show to share how he managed to build a working prototype of Marvel's Iron Man suit, how he nearly bankrupted the Bay Area's most prestigious 3D printing lab in the process, and what it was like to fly around with tiny jet engines strapped to his arms. He discusses how Oscar-winning director Peter Jackson helped him take to the skies in a real-life World War I dogfight, why his attempt to recreate one of World War II's most monumentally bizarre inventions was less than successful, and the importance of asking questions and embracing failure. Adam talks about his love of juggling and magic, his friendship with famous magician and leading skeptic, the amazing Randy, why Adam fears that the skeptic community has grown too hostile, and how he discovered that Darwinism doesn't make for good television. Plus his obsession with the dodo bird, and why coat hangers are a maker's best friend. Coming up with Adam Savage in just a moment. Adam Savage is the former co-host of the Discovery Channel television series Mythbusters and Unchained Reaction and the host of Mythbusters Jr. on the Science Channel. Prior to that, he was a special effects designer and fabricator whose model work has appeared in major films including Star Wars Episode II and The Matrix Reloaded. Now Adam has a new show called Savage Builds, which airs Fridays at 10 Eastern on the Science Channel. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Adam, I've been a fan of Mythbusters, and I really enjoyed your new show, Savage Builds. But until I read your resume here, I never knew how many different hats you've worn over the years. Animator, graphic designer, actor, carpenter, projectionist, film developer.
I am a serial skill collector. Yeah. I very much enjoy gathering new skills and solving problems with them. And I have been incredibly diverse in my employment history. Yeah.
Yeah, you've just about held every production job there is, I think. That's incredible. Do you like to kind of dabble in different areas and just mix it up a little bit? Do you find that one area informs the other?
It does. One area does inform the other. And I've always it is a weird thing to try and unpack the reasons for one's own success. However, I did well in several of my careers in making things. And I think one of the things that aided and abetted that was that I really like understanding the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And now as an employer, I know that when my employees understand what they're doing and how it fits into the bigger whole, they're better informed and are happier with their work. I have always been somebody who likes to understand how what I'm doing fits into the larger picture. And yeah, I'm never tired of learning a new thing. Over the last few years, one of the separate things I've done is take stage shows around the country and around the world. First with Jamie Hyneman, then with Michael Stevens from Vsauce. And every industry carries with it. It's shorthand. You know, the podcast industry has shorthand for people to understand what's going on about readership and reach. And in the touring industry, there's this lovely convention, which is, I mean, there's every imaginable type of tour. There's the Nutcracker to Hamilton to magic shows, right? They all require different types of infrastructure. And every theater that they go to is a different shape and size and has a different loading dock. I mean, with all of these different variables, you'd imagine that there's a huge amount of logistics to moving shows from theater to theater. And there are. However, the old timers in the industry only ever want to know one thing, which is how many 18-wheelers do you have? And that's the only fact that they need to know to know how it's going to affect their day. You have two 18-wheelers? We know exactly how long that loadout should take.
Yeah, yeah. That pretty much sums up the size of the show and everything.
Apparently,
doesn't it?
And that's, I love the simplicity of that. So the first guy that told me that, he was like, so U2's most recent world tour, 186 18-wheelers.
Oh, my God. Is that
the biggest
true?
Tour in history.
Wow.
They were so giant, they ruined every location they performed on. Not on purpose, but on purpose so that part of the budget for U2's tour was the $250,000 to resod every soccer pitch they set up on. Anyway, we were a two-truck show.
Two-truck. Okay.
Two trucks.
Okay.
Nice and
tight.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned magic shows a second ago. I read somewhere that you're a big fan of magic and juggling. Is that right?
I am.
Card throwing?
Well, you
Which
know,
a lot of
like
people
a lot
don't
of
know
lonely
what that
teenagers,
is, do they?
I gravitated towards the things that the ladies like.
Yeah. Perfect. Me too.
I'm lucky enough to count a lot of wonderful magicians as very close friends.
Yeah.
I am a big fan of magic. Penn and Teller, I love both their work those two guys.
Right.
When I went out on tour with Michael Stevens, I actually hired as the director of the tour a wonderful magician and magic designer named Michael Weber.
Oh, yeah.
Michael's been a collaborator, collaborator of Ricky Jay's for decades, and also David Blaine and many others. And Michael, the reason I wanted to do that is because I actually believe that magic, and I add comedy to this, magic and comedy are the two most difficult forms of narrative storytelling because they have immediate stakes.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And you send somebody a book and it's got a story
That's
in it.
True.
Those don't get me wrong. It's not that the stakes are smaller. It's that in comedy, if there's not a laugh, that joke didn't work. It doesn't matter how well you crafted it. And in magic, if you haven't gotten a surprise, if you haven't bent the brain of somebody, you haven't somehow tapped into the most essential part of that storytelling. So I've come to feel that magic and comedy are the two most rigorous forms of narrative that require the most attention to the finest detail.
Yeah.
So I hired a magician to direct our show, and it was great because really the kind of touring show that I enjoy the most feels like a magic show, except it's built with science.
Yeah. I think it was actually Penn who said something along the lines of magic is the only art where you can buy talent, or you can buy a career. you buy the trick, and you're a magician. You know, it's not like comedian where you have to have a joke.
I actually think I can add several dozen different industries to that list.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you could buy a welder. Yeah. You could buy a MIG welder for a couple of $100. Yeah. It sprays hot metal and electricity, and you could call yourself a welder.
Yeah, you could call yourself one, but it may not be a good one. Yeah.
And you could certainly go buy Magic Illusions and call yourself a magician, but no, it's not the real thing.
Is this how you got hooked up with the Amazing Randy? Because I know that you've done a bunch of his The Amazing Weekend or The Amazing Show, whatever they call that, conference.
Yeah, that was the first time I met Penn and Teller. Was that Randy asked me to come to the Amazing Meeting in Vegas.
Yeah, they're very close with them, aren't they?
Yeah, and Randy called me up. Randy called me on the phone one day. I think it was probably around 2005 or 2006. And he said, "Adam, this is the Amazing Randy." And I was like, "No. Randy," I said, "I watched you live doing the milk bottle escape on Happy Days in 1971. I literally was watching that show as it aired." And he was like, "Well, you're one of my heroes for spreading the good word of empirical-based understanding of the world." And I was like, "I'm your hero. That's stupid. I love you, Randy." I still love Randy. So cool. He's still a friend and an amazing guy. I have pulled back from the skeptics communities.
Oh, really?
I have.
What? Tell me why.
They have descended into. I don't know whether it's. I'm not going to say it's intrinsic to the skeptics, because this happens to so many groups, but it's just descended into a bunch of infighting and yelling that doesn't have any bearing on what the real mission is to me.
What do skeptics argue about? Don't they kind of all agree on the empirical evidence?
It turns out that there's a whole bunch of folks in the movement who are highly misogynistic. And
really? Yeah, oh, interesting.
And I can't abide that for even a second.
Yeah. I mean, I could probably see something like that on Reddit, in Reddit communities and that kind of thing.
You want to go look at anything Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins has said recently.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Like, I had Richard
people
on
that
a
I
year
formerly
ago.
Admired I espousing ridiculous racist bullshit.
Wow.
So I pull back.
Oh, my God.
What I call myself now.
Wow.
I'm trying to piss everybody off. I'm actually trying to please everyone, because that's my central path. I call myself a New Testament agnostic. I can't say atheist because it's not scientifically reasonable, right?
Okay.
I can't know.
There's no
know. So I'm an agnostic, which I take to, and I recognize there are multiple definitions for agnostic. People on Twitter have schooled me. Mm-hmm. I get that there are many definitions. I mean the one that is culturally prevalent of I don't know don't know yes, I don't know no.
Right.
So that's me agnostic, and I say New Testament agnostic because I agree with everything Jesus said.
Right. Okay. Right.
I have no problems with any.
The message is fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think he'd have a problem if he showed up today.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's so heartening to hear you say that, because, you know, I've said this for probably at least a year or two now. Fewer and fewer times do I hear people saying just simply, "I don't know." No one says, "I don't know" anymore.
No one says,
"What
I don't know."
Happened?
Well, and so the other thing about it is, the last linchpin in there is I read and I loved Hitchens for all of his insanity.
Sure.
I loved God Is Not Good.
Yeah.
And without a doubt, the most horrifying crimes have been perpetrated under religion. But when I think about my intersection with religion, I'm fourth generation has no use for the church. Like, my grandparents never went to church. Their grandparents never went to church.
Right. Your mom was a psychologist.
Yeah.
Psychiatrist.
My mom was a psychotherapist. Yeah. My dad was an artist. However, I count among my friends many who have a deep, abiding faith.
Yeah.
And it is an incredibly important part of their lives. And when they talk about their faith and what it means to them, I am moved. And I feel a universality there. And they might call it, what they feel might be God, I might feel might be art or the other, the universal unconscious. You know, I don't have answers to those. Mm-hmm. These are the biggest questions there are.
Yeah.
But I notice how moved I am by the radical acceptance of those who those friends of mine, those people I love who have a real faith and who go to church. Mm-hmm.
Well, it all comes from a good place. It all comes from a place of love, in theory, you know.
In theory, yes, it does. And I am moved when it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to put it.
And years back, I read that you had, I guess, proposed an episode of MythBusters where you were going to attempt to disprove or to prove natural selection over creationism. Yeah. Whatever happened to that episode?
Well, you know, it's,
or was that part of I Don't Know?
It's not part of I Don't Know. Okay. There are plenty of things you can do. There's just not many that are at all televisual from a narrative and producing standpoint. It also, it's not addressing
the issue. Big bang. I mean, you tell me that's not good television?
Yeah. The thing I realized after I said that was, like, going after creationists is really low-hanging fruit, as far as I'm concerned. It's that's not the problem that we're addressing. It's like flat earthers. It's this tiny minority. I mean, infinitesimal, almost statistically insignificant minority, along with moon landing deniers and other dopes. That it's not even worth debating, right? So that's the other part. That I really agree with the idea that, like, no, I'm not going to debate you about climate change. It's not worth debating. There's, to say that it's worth debating.
You don't want to elevate it.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was fascinated by the idea of the moths in England that changed their color because of the coal smoke. However, there's like there's all sorts of interesting issues which I can't remember now because my brain is a sieve. But each time I looked into ways of empirically showing a natural selection process, it was either going to take way too long, include a gigantic sample of creatures that were infinitesimally small and thus unfilmable, and it turned out it wasn't even the problem.
Okay. And what's your deal with the dodo bird?
Oh my God, I just love
the dodo. Is that part
of
the natural selection thing or what?
No, it's actually a really interesting question. The dodo famously, of course, went extinct in the 17th century on the island of Mauritius off the eastern coast of Africa, off of Madagascar. And it was so close to us, right? Like, there are probably heirlooms in my family that were built when the dodos were alive, right?
This is their close in terms of time.
Yeah, right. This is 300 or 400 years ago. It's very close to us. It's three old people stacked against each other, right? Five or six old people. That closeness and yet its invisibility, right? So for the longest time, even though we had dozens of dodo skeletons all around the world in museums, and there are tens of thousands of dodo bones in the ground in Mauritius, there was no dodo skeleton where all the bones came from a single specimen.
Oh, really?
That's how poor our record keeping was and how little we valued the idea of extinction and the rarity of these events. The British Museum, I said this in my TED talk, the British Museum had a full sample. But in some space-saving zeal in the 19th century, they cut off the head and the feet, and they saved those, and they burned the rest. And when you look at those specimens, it says the rest was lost in a fire, quote unquote. So for me, the dodo represents this kind of wonderful human myopia that I'm kind of thrilled by. I'm also thrilled by lost texts. I was just talking to someone about this last night. I love the idea that we only have, a couple of dozen Greek plays, even though there were thousands.
Yeah.
And I know that there are more, and we'll find them in someone's attic or a library somewhere mislabeled or a palimpsest or something like that. There's the idea of the lost knowledge found again, because I believe it was the museum on Mauritius found a specimen that does have all the bones a single specimen.
Remarkable.
Huh. It actually informs all sorts of new understanding about it, and they're still studying it, and there are wonderful experts around the world taking a look at this specimen. To me, that stuff is all sort of part and parcel. And it connects me, it connects my head to the line of history in a way I find kind of intellectually stimulating.
Yeah.
So I don't think you expected such a long answer for
No, I really, I certainly appreciate that. And, you know, that's why I never throw out books, Because in my mind, I think, what if that's the last copy of this book that someone put their heart and soul into? And
you say
and
that
I
is,
think,
I
what
just...
if I wrote a book and that was the last record of something that I had put on paper and some jerk threw it away because it was taking up too much room on
the same
bookshelf.
Time, at the same time, We probably have 150 linear feet of books in my house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Maybe even a couple hundred. And we just have gone through this whole process of reorganizing where the categories, fiction, poetry, film, plays, et cetera, nonfiction, which is a whole shit fight because how do you split up nonfiction?
Right.
Right. Histories, politics, et cetera. Anyway, and in doing
and then
so,
then biography messes it up too.
Biography and history, right? Is endurance biography?
Yeah, exactly.
Or is it history? So it all gets kind of spongy. But in doing so, we created a pile of probably 20 feet. Of 20 linear feet of books. And our friends, just everybody who comes over has to scan the pile because there's some great stuff in there. And there's a lot of stuff that are great books that I just happened to buy two of, or my wife and I each owned a
copy. Same here. Yeah. Every time I have an author on, they must send me like two or three books and I can't just get rid of it. I have to give it to someone or do something.
Totally agree
with
that ethos.
Book.
Yeah. Someone gives you a book, you got to give it away.
Well, you know, coming from a film and television background, I have to wonder, did you ever imagine that you would have become one of the leading popularizers of science now?
No.
No.
No. You know.
Because you are. You rank up there with, I would say, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Michio Kaku and those, others like that.
All those guys are heroes of mine. And it's funny that I went through a lot of different iterations of what I thought my job was when I was making Mythbusters. At first, I thought I was just hired to build experiments. I thought it was hired to build stuff. Some of that was part of experiments and some of that was set dressing. And then I realized, oh, no, I've got to be talking about this stuff, so I got to know it a little better. I started doing the research. And then I realized when we were filming the episode about will a penny thrown from the Empire State Building kill you when it hits the ground, I ended up building a wind tunnel that showed that a penny has two terminal velocities. This was not something that I found anybody else had ever done. And it's not that it's that difficult to do, but I did it myself in order to physically demonstrate the twin terminal velocities rather than say the math. Mm-hmm. And that told me I had something real to contribute to the show. It was a real sea change in the first season when I came up with that. And so then I realized, okay, so it's methodological design. That's what I can And somewhere around the middle of Mythbusters' tenure, 2007, 2008, I'm in a podcast with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, yeah.
You just mentioned.
Star Talk.
In New York
whatever.
At Star Talk. I'm doing his podcast, Star Talk, and I'm watching him go, and I'm thinking, look at this guy. He is a vat-grown science communicator. This is his mission. He is a proselytizer. I'll bet there's planets on his underpants, right? Like, this guy is committed. And then I thought, that is such a cool mission to have. And then I realized, oh, I am also a science communicator. That is also my mission.
Yeah.
Right? And we take that mission. And then I ultimately came around to realize, for me, the step goes one level higher. Not higher, but one level elsewhere. And the elsewhere is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That when I was a model maker on Star Wars, gluing little bits of plastic models onto spaceships, the aesthetics of where that little plastic bit goes and whether it's level or not and what goes to it and from it and the paint job it gets, all of those decisions are informed by a story that's in the head of the person acting upon that little piece of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And if I, as the model maker, don't have a clear story about what that thing is and does, I don't have to have a actual story of, oh, this is the turbine encabulator. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, if I look at it and it doesn't feel right, the story's not being told correctly.
Right.
And so I'm imbuing this object with the right narrative to help the filmmaker tell their story.
Mm-hmm. Again, looking at the big picture, how it all fits in.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because the big picture of the Star Wars universe is very different than the big picture of the Star Trek universe. They have radically different aesthetics, and you better understand them at least intuitively. Otherwise, you won't be able to model make within those universes.
Yeah.
And so I realized that what I've been doing on Mythbusters and what I continue to do, even with my science proselytization of science, is point out to people that all we're doing is we're building stories to understand the world and the universe. And this is my this was the real understanding I came to from making the show Mythbusters, is that science and art are not either ends of a spectrum. They are simply two different ways that we tell stories to better understand ourselves and our universe. And one is arguably more rigorous, and the other is arguably more emotional. But cases, there are plenty of outliers and plenty of crossover. They bend deeply.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Adam Savage when we come back in just a moment. To most Americans, the dealings of the Department of Defense are a mystery, and the Pentagon nothing more than an opaque five-sided box that they regard with a mixture of awe and suspicion. Now in his new book, Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon, former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter sheds light on all that happens inside one of the nation's most iconic and most closely guarded buildings, taking readers behind the scenes to reveal the inner workings of the Pentagon, its vital mission, and what it takes to lead. Drawn from Carter's 36 years of leadership experience in the DoD, this is the essential book for understanding the challenge of defending America in a dangerous world and imparting a trove of incisive lessons that can guide leaders in a complex organization. Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg says this book should be required reading for every citizen who wants to know more about how our country stays secure. And Henry Kissinger says this book should be essential reading for anyone concerned about the evolution that technology and political upheavals around the world impose on us. Order Inside the Five-Sided Box, Lessons from a Lifetime of Leadership in the Pentagon on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And now, back to the show. I have to say, it just seems like you have the funnest job in the world. Do you still get that thrill every time you get to take something that you've built and then put it to the test?
I do. Yeah, and that thrill's on camera, and I love bringing that thrill to the story. I will add, commensurate with that, it's also the hardest job. Like everything that we do, that whenever we are doing something that we truly love and that we want, because we love it, we want it to be as good as it can be. Mm-hmm. It's going to take every last ounce of our effort and our energy and our heart. And so the thing I like to point out to people is Mythbusters and Savage Builds is no different. It is so much fun making that show, and I'm making it with my family. These are people I worked with on Mythbusters for more than a decade and a half. So it's a great set. It's a great crew. It's a great build environment. And it's also the most difficult 4 months I've had in my life.
I'm sure.
You know, you put your whole self into the thing.
Yeah. And I have to imagine that it's got to be somewhat heartbreaking when you build something and you're really rooting for it to be able to pull it off, and then it just doesn't pan out or goes sideways.
And so that happened in the second season of Savage, and sorry, in the second episode of Savage Builds, where we replicated the Great Panjandrum.
Explain what that is, because I don't think most people know what a panjandrum.
Yeah,
I can't even say it right.
A panjandrum. It was a real tongue twister for everybody. A panjandrum. Picture a giant steel frame that describes a spool with 10-foot wheels and about a 6-foot wide axle between them. And the panjandrum was a way for the Allies to get munitions up and over all the obstacles on the beaches at Normandy to get to the seawall to blow it up. So this spool, each of these 10-foot tall wheels, was powered by rockets so that it would drive up and over all the hedgehogs and steel embankments and concertina wire and deliver the 2,000 pounds of explosives on its axle to the seawall and blow it up so the Allies could get through. And the British tested it on the beaches of England during World War II and could never get it to aim correctly. They tried cables. They had rockets misfiring. And the footage of them trying it is appalling.
Yeah. and it's rocket propelled, which looks like something a kid would build.
It does. And there are rockets flying all over and dogs running around and there's people standing there watching. It looks like this terrifyingly lethal thing. And so it's easy to look at that and think, what a bunch of idiots. This is super absurd. And I realized when talking to the production team about this show, I realized, no, this is actually an engineer solution. You have big obstacles, make big wheels.
Yeah.
That's really clever, actually. Less moving parts means less things that can go wrong.
Right.
Rocket powered mean you don't have an engine transmission to deal with. There's all sorts of ways in which the specifics are generated by great engineering thinking. And so Adam Stelzner, a wonderful engineer scientist at Jet Propulsion Labs and a friend of mine, came and worked with me for a couple of weeks to redesign the Panjandrum to be driven by centrifugal force, to be basically to spin up a pair of 800 pounds of flywheel on the side of our Panjandrum and tap into that with truck brakes to make the thing spin and move forward. And it was a great idea, and it totally didn't work. And when it became clear to me that it didn't work, my first thought was, crap, really? it was the very first thing we shot. It was that, you know, you shoot out of order.
Yeah.
It was the very first thing we shot. So we're at the end of this, and it's also January in San Francisco, which this year was one of the wettest winters we've ever had.
So muddy.
Muddy, muddy, muddy. We got bounced from several locations in a single story, which I've never been bounced from a location because of weather ever.
Yeah.
In Northern California, really rare. So this episode was a grueling bear of a battle every single day. And on the last day, as the sun is setting and this thing totally craps the bed, I looked at it and I was like, okay, I have to accept that we don't have any more money to do this again. That we're out of time, so there's no more days, and this thing definitely doesn't work, and so there is no catharsis
here.
And so then I thought, because it comes down to me, I'm the executive producer of this show. This is I've got my name on it, I've got my face on it. What story can I tell? And then I thought, okay, this moment happens at the very end of the episode, and so I'm the viewer, and I want to. What do I have to achieve as the producer to help the viewer? Well, this is about 3 minutes before the end of the episode. So what I need is to know that I have story to tell between this failure and the end of the episode that keeps me, the viewer, invested in the story.
Yeah.
And I realized, no, the story of an iterative failure is an important one and an abiding one, and one that both Adam Stelzner and his capacity at JPL and I and my capacity as a Mythbuster have experienced many, many times. Many of the things we try don't work, and that's part of the process.
Right, right.
It's not a failure. It's simply an iteration. And I realize I can tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can bring some gasoline and I can blow it up because that's fun and give a little bit of a show.
Yeah.
But I don't think that to me, the realization that I get to tell an honest story about iteration and add a little bit of bombast and spectacle to dress it up, and the discovery, my network, is such a good partner that they accept that.
Yeah.
Right? I was terrified handing them the cut of this show and they'd be like, what? You can't make a show where you fail? I was totally expecting that. And they were like, no, we like this episode. And I thought, this is great. Because
that's science. Discovery should definitely embrace that. We want people to dare to try and fail and then try again.
There's nothing more intimidating to people than unfettered success.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And so when we look at someone like Elon Musk, we're like, wow, PayPal, Tesla, SpaceX. And it's like, I am so sure if you could unpack the can of Elon Musk, you'd find all sorts of horrifying failure and self-doubt in there.
I think we are right now.
It's plausible. And it's really important that we normalize and talk about that. Because when we only show successes, that makes kids think what I used to think, which is that science is only for smart people.
Right.
And the fact is, it's not. Yeah. The distribution of idiots is equivalent across every field, including science. And if you think you have a proclivity, you have something to contribute. My biggest goal with science communication is helping kids realize that it's not an avocation, it's just a vocation.
Yeah.
And more than that, there's every single working scientist I have ever encountered loves their job. And I don't know many industries in which I can say that exact thing. right? Yeah, like, you know, not every copywriter I know loves their job. Yeah. In fact, most of them hate it. Right? There's a lot of industries where it's just like, you know, sometimes that's just, a job is just a job.
Yeah.
But every scientist I know, whether they're measuring the, you know, the methane in the feces of tsetse flies or the migrating patterns of something, they really love and believe in their work.
Well, yeah, and it's also, it's what you were saying earlier about, you know, the power of just admitting, I don't know. And science is one of those few fields where they celebrate being wrong as much as they celebrate being right.
Right.
There's still that thrill of discovery when they're wrong. And maybe it's more exciting.
I think science can do more to celebrate being wrong. There's a thing being talked about right now, which is that we very rarely publish scientific studies with a null result.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Which means we only publish, which means there's a bias on behalf of the scientific publishing industry and thus the people who publish papers and thus people who write papers, that a scientific study has to achieve some understanding of something. Oh, you have to see some big difference in the data.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of tests you can do where you get no data or you get a null result, and that's a result. That's an information about how that thing works or doesn't work and what affects it.
Yeah.
That idea of saying I don't know is the most important, and it's really important to realize also that nobody knows.
Yeah.
I once went to I was in a legal battle with someone a few years ago, and their stance on every aspect of the legal battle was, well, we'll just take it to court and get them to decide, as if there was just like the back of a box that someone could read and follow a path. And the answer I realized going through all this legal crap was, no, there's absolutely no hard and fast rules for any of this. It's all interpretive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And who knows what kind of jury you get.
Yeah. And science is the same exact way. I think a lot of people think, well, I don't know, but also I'm assuming somebody knows. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, the end of every line of questioning is, we have no idea.
Yeah.
What is gravity? Well, I can tell you what it does, and I can tell you about the inverse square law, and I can very finely measure its effects. But what is it? Who knows? What is sentience? No idea.
No idea. Well, I got to bring up episode one of Savage Builds. You build a working replica of the Iron Man suit.
Yes.
What was the hardest part of that project, aside from just getting permission from Marvel?
Actually, getting permission from Marvel was about the easiest.
Really?
Well,
no kidding.
I am 1 degree separated from Kevin Feige, who I have spoken to and met on a couple of occasions. We are Mutual Admiration Society. I mean, that guy, my hat is off to him. The MCU is incredible. And so I'm 1 degree removed from Kevin. So I sent a letter that got sent to him that asked for permission. And he was like, I love this idea. Let's make this work. And he just waved a magic MCU wand and made it happen.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that
so
easy?
Wow. Shane Mahan, amazing designer of incredible special effects, going back to, I mean, many of your favorite movies, from Jurassic Park to, you know, tons and tons of stuff at Legacy Effects, formerly Stan Winston Studios. They supplied me with their original computer files of the Iron Man Mark II armor. So the stuff I thought was going to be impossible turned out to actually work like clockwork and beautiful. One of the most difficult parts was the computer files were 275 some odd separate computer files.
Wow.
Each one describing a single facet of Iron Man's armor without any instructions about how they went together. So when EOS, the manufacturers of the titanium 3D printer, who generously donated all the 3D printing for this episode.
Yeah, that was cool.
Which again was, that was arguably, the episode wouldn't have happened without them. Mm-hmm. It was $250,000 worth of 3D printing.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I think we almost broke them. I don't think we, not that we broke their machines, but we pushed their machines to their limit.
Yeah.
And their wonderful technician, Austin, who lives in Austin, we really almost broke poor Austin.
That was cool. They 3D printed in titanium, right?
They did.
I didn't even know you could do that yet.
Yeah. And actually, I'm really proud of the narrative piece we put into the show that describes how the 3D printing process works, in which effectively powdered titanium alloy is laid in a micro layer on top of a platen, and then a laser melts it, and then another powdered layer is laid down on top of that, and a laser melts that to the previous layer, and slowly over thousands of these layers you build an object. But what orientation it's in depends, dictates how much it could or could not warp while it's in situ. These prints take a, there's a big time investment in each print and a big material investment. You can't quite always reuse the titanium powder. So it's a tricky process.
Wow.
And then there's compounded by the fact that nothing sticks to titanium. So how are we going to attach these pieces to each other became another challenge.
Yeah.
There are industrial adhesives, but they often take some caustic acids to prepare titanium's surface to be glued. And again, we didn't have any kind of time like this. Every part of the episode after approval and getting the computer files was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I mean, a nightmare in the best way, right? Like the Colorado School of Mines, Craig and his team of grad students were amazing. I love that school. I love that campus, that faculty, that student body. They like put in so many hours grinding titanium for us. And then.
Yeah. Because this wasn't just a costume. I feel like I should point that out. This wasn't a costume. This was a working Iron Man suit that flies and is bulletproof and all that.
Well, so to be clear, when we started the episode, I simply knew that I had given a talk at the Colorado School of Mines. They had said, we got this brand new 3D printer that prints in titanium. You want to print anything with it? And I said, can you print a suit of armor? I had no idea how long it takes. And they were like, yeah. So I went back to San Francisco. We're in pre-production on Savage Builds, and we're talking about stuff. And I suggested a suit of medieval armor in titanium. And one of my team said, what about Iron Man armor? Because I had previously expressed I'd always wanted to make an Iron Man costume. I, in fact, have a couple of fiberglass unfinished suits of Iron Man armor in my collection that I've never gotten around to finishing. And he said, what about Iron Man? And I thought, actually, I could make that happen. And again, I was still thinking of this as, at this point, it's just a gag in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, 3D printed titanium, that's awesome. Iron Man armor, that's great. We can put those together and we can get these things rolling. And now that ball seems to be rolling, which is great. But then we get to the Colorado School of Mines and one of the students shows me a scanning electron microscope photo of regular titanium and the sintered 3D printed titanium. And it turns out every metal has its own properties of its flexibility or ductility, its springiness, its softness. And often within metal groups, these properties can be adjusted with alloys, i.e. adding other metals to the metal that you're using, and also by the application of heat under careful conditions.
Yeah.
So for instance, that whole thing where you heat a steel sword up to and then quench it in oil, these are all ways to adjust the internal structure of the steel to be both hard and flexible enough to be a sword.
Okay.
Well, when you're 3D printing titanium, it turns out you can actually attenuate its grain structure in the 3D printing process itself to be far more impact resistant and springy than normal titanium. And that's when I realized, whoa, I'm not making a thing that equates to an Iron Man suit. I'm actually making a real working prototype, which I might have said something along those lines at the beginning of this episode when we started going, but realizing that I could say that and be 100% truthful. If Tony Stark showed up today, this is how he'd start making this suit.
Yeah, yeah.
Being able to say that then now makes it a bit of narrative meat that I can sink my teeth into.
Yeah, I mean, this was a working prototype of an Iron Man suit.
And it's not powered inside with all sorts of crazy, intricate mechanics.
No nuclear power.
Yeah. I'm it's not powered by cold fusion, and I don't have repulsors and all of that.
Yeah.
But it is bulletproof, and we did get it to fly. I mean, I will tell you that at so many stages, and if any of my crew, a team, or Colorado School of Mines people are listening, they're probably smiling ruefully to themselves because at least 50 different moments in the process of making this episode, we were all sure it wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
We were all sure like, we're going to have to give this one. It's not going to. Oh, no, this isn't going to go.
I was skeptical, especially the propulsion system because you had these Popeye-like forearms, mini jet engines that are strapped to your forearms.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to use those to be able to maneuver. Huh?
Totally amazing. that's Richard Browning's gravity rig, and I got to learn how to fly in it.
Yeah.
That was another totally amazing part of that episode.
Yeah, that was just awesome. I also read that you do an episode with director Peter Jackson. What was that one about?
Well, Peter, I've been friends with Peter for a few years, and to be clear, I have a whole family now down in Wellington, New Zealand. Peter and his wife, Fran. I love those guys and their family. And Richard Taylor and his team at Weta Workshop, I now count many among them as my close friends and my family. I love that place. I love those people. So any excuse I have to get to Wellington, I take it. And I run there. And I called Peter up because he is obsessed with World War One.
Oh, right. Yeah. Obsessed. He did that documentary recently.
He made that beautiful documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. But he also put up a magnificent exhibit in Wellington, New Zealand that ran for several years on World War One, specifically on the Gallipoli campaign, but also on the Somme. And as part of his obsession with World War One, he loves the airplanes, and he started collecting them. And then 20 years ago, he built an airplane factory that is the only one in the world that makes World War One airplanes.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Cool.
And he builds them precisely to the original blueprints. So it's a little bit of a misnomer in my head to call them replicas, because they are exact in every possible detail. There is no, like, every bit of gum rubber is the same type of gum rubber specced in the original. Every bit of leather, every bit of springiness and steel and fastener is the same spec. The only difference, I think they told me, was instead of old wood glue or rabbit skin glue, they used epoxy glue for the wood spars because it's way more stable and lasts a lot longer. A couple of years ago when I was in New Zealand, I'd gone up to the Masterton to fly in his planes. He'd given me a couple of flights, and it was beautiful. And I called him up and said, I'd love to be able to dogfight in your planes. What if we attached laser tag to them? And he said, yes, I would love that. And this is informed by the fact that Peter told me that he and his family love to play laser tag.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they have this big property and they play laser tag on them. And I think that's awesome. And so I thought it would be great to do it on the planes.
That's
and I brought
so cool.
in this wonderful, wonderful electronics designer, Zach, who designed an incredible system of because it's laser tag is hard to play in direct sunlight.
Over
long
yeah.
distances. And we wanted our laser tag system to be accurate over the same distance that these planes would have had to be for dogfighting. Mm-hmm. So it had to be, I think, about 100 yards, around 100 yards is where you'd be close enough to actually start harming your opponent, right? So we designed a system, and we actually didn't use one sensor per plane. We used 15 per plane. Because we had lethal hits on the pilot, that would bring a plane down.
Yeah.
Hit on the engine, that would make the engine fail. But hits on the body, those aren't going to do anything to one of those planes. They're just going to go right through canvas, and the plane still flies.
Yeah.
So we wanted to know how many non-lethal hits we were getting as well. And then that led to me and the pilots, Bevan and Gary, learning. I mean, because these guys are – they both fly these old planes for a living. They're basically historical reenactors, and they read the accounts of the original pilots to learn about the flying techniques that they were doing. And they were applying that knowledge to the dogfighting we were doing.
Wow.
I realized at the end of the episode, I might even say it in the episode, I can't remember, is that what we actually built was a time machine.
Oh, cool.
Because by the third dogfight, Peter's down there on the field in his observation vehicle watching us with binoculars. And we are like actively working hard to try and get each other into our sights. And I'm in the gunner seat, which is not a seat at all. It is a wooden platform with a cable going from my waist to a hole in the floor. And I'm holding on to this gun, which swivels when I grab these two bicycle brakes. And I'm trying to do that in 100-plus mile per hour winds while also pulling G's and negative G's. This pilot is rolling up and over. And each time we come down, we're assessing how that went. And it was actually really difficult. It was much more difficult in many ways for all of us involved in a way that was really neat.
Yeah.
Because each time we came down, the pilots were like, oh, I learned so much more about the history that I've read. Like, I understood this maneuver.
Yeah, you get to see it in real time.
And to experience, like, even for all the Fokkers, the German Fokker, that was our triplane enemy, for all of its
I thought you were being crude.
No. For all of the Fokker's well-earned reputation as an incredible acrobatic plane, there were still some situations in which having a two-seat plane where a gunner can concentrate on you can be a very lethal combination.
Wow.
And we totally proved that. It was really neat.
That's so cool. And those things looked kind of flimsy from the footage I've
seen.
You're braver than I am.
Except that I point this out. And this is also sort of part of the point of the whole episode is they do look flimsy. They're made out of wood and canvas, and they're made out of a bunch of not very exotic materials in general. And when you get into one to take a flight, it's called a tail dragger, right? Because it sits there not level on the landing field, but it's tail down, and you're at this angle, and you don't feel quite comfortable because it just doesn't feel quite natural. And the plane starts to take off, and it takes off on grass, so it's this rumbly start. Yeah. And then the tail lifts up, and the plane pulls off the ground. And you realize, and then all of a sudden, it feels super stable.
Huh.
And you realize, I think every human that would be in one of these planes could feel that stability. As an engineer, what I understand is I'm in a machine built to do a thing. And until it's doing that thing, it doesn't feel stable. On the ground and rumbling along, it feels like this rickety canvas and wood cart. But the moment it takes to the air, I'm in a machine not only designed and built to be in the air, but designed over such a rigorously iterative process between 1914 and 1918, when the British went from 250 planes? No, 25 planes to 25,000 planes in 4 years. Constantly iterating to improve, to keep up with the enemy, to add advancements and add reliability. That these machines were designed and built by the greatest engineers on Earth at the moment they were built.
Wow.
They are the atomic bombs of their age. I hate to use such a destructive thing, but there is a Manhattan Project.
Yeah, that was cutting edge technology.
Project was the greatest minds of that generation or of any generation. Mm-hmm. World War I airplanes are very much the same thing.
Incredible.
So this is the reason they build them precisely to the blueprints, because these are perfectly tuned systems in which each part of that system relies on each other part. And as one of their engineers told me, if we replaced something with carbon fiber, well, that's never going to break, and it's going to put stress on some other part of the plane that we can't predict. And thus all of our maintenance schedules don't actually work anymore.
Wow.
Right. So what I wanted to show was it's easy to look at the past and think, oh, well, that's the old way of doing things. And there are certainly processes and technologies that were used on these planes that we don't use anymore because we don't have to. But that doesn't mean that they were primitive in any sense of the word.
Wow.
The joy I get as an engineer of looking at these things and having the knowledge about them laid into me by the engineers and the people who fly these planes and Peter himself, and realizing what magnificent machines they are.
Yeah.
And they're so far from primitive. That's the story I went down there to tell.
Yeah. I can tell that you have so much fun with your job. I don't know if I've ever met anyone who has as much enthusiasm for what they do as you do, Adam. Before we go, real quickly, I just have to ask, what is the most useful tool or material that you always keep on you when you're working?
Oh, okay. Material.
Or what is the most essential thing?
Okay, essential is different than useful.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay.
I almost never don't have a Leatherman multi-tool at my disposal.
Okay.
And the two things I use on that all the time are the pliers and the knife blade.
Okay.
They allow me to grab and to cut. These are the most two of the most basic operations. As far as materials, if you gave me only one or two, I mean, I might choose simple cardboard and coat hanger wire.
Really?
Yeah.
Coat hanger wire.
Coat hanger wire is one of my favorite things in the world.
Really?
It's the fingernail of materials. It's not too hard. It's not too soft, and it's always where you need it.
Okay.
I love coat hangers. I actually harvest coat hangers.
Yeah.
Which means when I get a crap ton from everyone ends up with a crap ton of wire hangers.
Yeah.
What I do is I cut out the straight parts, and I actually have a rack in my shop for the long straight part. I don't bother unbending them. It's not worth my time.
Yeah.
Right? So I simply cut out the long parts and store those in a rack. And there are many different thicknesses of the wire, but in almost every case, it is soft enough to be workable and hard enough to be useful.
Wow, you're the opposite of Mommy Dearest. You're like, more wire coat hangers, more wire coat hangers.
I hope in every way that I am the opposite of Mommy Dearest.
Well, again, Savage Builds airs Fridays at 10 Eastern on the Science Channel. Adam Savage, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Adam Savage for coming on the podcast. Don't miss his new show, Savage Builds, Fridays at 10 Eastern on the Science Channel. For more fun stuff, visit adamsavage.com and follow him on Twitter at @don'ttrythis. Yes, that's right, @don'ttrythis. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.